in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids, Mahomet; Bates Commodities Incorporated, Normal; and Colonial Pantry, Champaign. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the afternoon magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Wind, it is a force of nature that makes life possible on the Earth. We also know how dangerous it can be. It can kill. On the program today, we're going to take a closer look at wind, from sweet summer breezes to severe tropical storms. Our guest is writer and editor Mark DeVilliers. His latest book is Windswept, The Story of Wind and Weather. He opens the book with a story from his childhood on the coast of South Africa. There, one day in a park, a gust of wind knocked him down and blew him across the lawn into some metal railings. Those railings saved him from being swept into the ocean. In his words, at that instant, for that child and the man he became, wind became personal, a thing capricious and malevolent, to be treated with the utmost caution and constant suspicion. Today, our guest, Mark DeVilliers, lives on the Atlantic coast of North America in Nova Scotia, where, he says, he remains wary, and with good reason. The gales and hurricanes of the North Atlantic are to be respected. While wind has earned the respect of our guest, it has piqued his curiosity since his childhood, and in this book, Windswept, he shares with us what he's learned. Mark DeVilliers is the author of several books, including Sahara, The Extraordinary History of the World's Largest Desert. His book, Water, Fate of Our Most Precious Resource, won Canada's prestigious Governor General's Award. His latest book, Windswept, The Story of Wind and Weather, is published by Walker. Mark DeVilliers, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much.
Hello, Celeste. Thank you.
Wind makes life possible. Let's stop and consider that statement for a while.
Without wind, there would, in fact, be no transference of heat from the equator to the poles, or vice versa, and the Earth would bake in the middle and freeze at the poles, and the only life possible would be on the margins. So life, including our lives, is utterly dependent on wind systems and the transference of air and heat that they produce. And that applies even to the worst windstorms, like hurricanes, which are actually a natural part of our system and necessary in that sense.
Hmm. That's pretty tough to swallow.
Well, it is. I mean, it seems when a hurricane's bearing down on you, it's pretty impossible to think of this, oh, this is a benign force of nature and part of the natural systems. But you know what? It is. And it transfers massive amounts of water from one latitude to another. It clarifies and cleans the air. It does, and it helps move ocean currents. It does a lot of very complicated things. Is a byproduct, of course. It also destroys houses and, as we've seen, even towns and sometimes cities.
But
it's part of the natural system, and there's no getting around that, and nor should we, even if we could, nor should we try and stop them.
Hmm. Tornadoes also part of the natural system?
Absolutely. again, those people who are victims of tornadoes can be forgiven for thinking them, as I occasionally do, as malevolent forces. But they're redistribution forces of their own from great thunder cells, and they discharge intense pressure differentials. And so, yes, they're perfectly normal and natural. It's just that we're vulnerable to them, and so is a lot, are a lot of other life forms. It's there's a bad side to the good, but there is a good side to the bad side. That's what I learned in studying wind and wind patterns.
Mm. You know, the last hurricane season was a record breaker.
Right.
And the next season looms, and it begins on June 1st in the peak.
Well, occasionally it begins before then, and it sometimes ends in November and sometimes
right.
goes after. Yes, last year was a record breaker in the number of storms and also in their intensity in the Atlantic Basin, bear in mind. Globally, in fact, it wasn't anywhere near a record year.
Yeah. Well, we're told that we are in a time of heightened Atlantic hurricane activity.
Yes.
Why do we have these cycles of heightened activity?
There are a large number of interlocking and overlapping natural cycles that operate in the meteorological system. The El Nino and La Nina systems are perhaps the best known, but there are many of them, and some of them work on 24-month patterns, and some of them work on decadal patterns, and some of them are even longer than that. And occasionally they intersect and overlap and change the preconditions which lead to large storms. And we're about since the late 70s, we're in a period of heightened activity in the Atlantic Basin. Curiously, though, in the last 4 or 5 years, studies have shown that there are actually fewer hurricanes and fewer tropical storms now than they were a decade ago. But that, alas, does not apply to us. It doesn't apply to the Atlantic Basin. It applies globally only. So while the number of storms and storm days has been actually going down, the number of storms in the Atlantic has been going up, most of it attributable to perfectly natural and entirely predictable cycles. However, the intensity of those storms has been increasing also, and there's pretty persuasive evidence that it has to do with increased sea surface temperatures, which in turn is derived from the warming of the atmosphere.
Hmm.
So global warming may not necessarily produce more storms. It may, in fact, produce fewer storms, but it's very likely to produce storms that are greater than we've been accustomed to in their intensity and velocity.
Would you tell us about where and how Atlantic hurricanes form?
The early season hurricanes tend to form in the western tropical Atlantic, but most hurricanes actually come a long way further than that. Many of them start in the what is still the greatest desert on Earth, in the Sahara, and sometimes in the deep Sahara. One of the storms that I tracked in the book, Ivan of 2004, which has become a kind of legendary storm for meteorologists because it's the only storm that ever has approached Category 5 status, not once but three times, began not only in the central Sahara, but in fact in the eastern Sahara, thousands of miles from the Atlantic, as a large sudden updraft of superheated air in the Saharan summer, which went up a mountain chain called the Tibesti and collided with cold air there and formed a thunder cell, which started to drift westwards, and it drifted across some quite legendary towns, Timbuktu among them, and went out into the Atlantic, where the prevailing winds and the currents took it down to tropical waters, and it started to revolve and become a tropical depression, and then a tropical storm, and then an embryo hurricane, and within a week after that, it was a hurricane of significant force. And that's a fairly typical track. They come out of the Sahara, they drift south into the low latitudes around 10 to 15 degrees, and then the prevailing trade winds and the prevailing patterns take them westwards towards, alas, the Caribbean and the southerly part of the United States. Many of them as we know, to our cost, actually do make landfall on the islands and in the southern U.S. Occasionally, they curve northwards and then occasionally even further northeastwards, sometimes intersect with New England, and indeed with Nova Scotia, where I live on the Canadian East Coast, so we had a hurricane of quite significant strength a couple of years ago here. So that's the typical pattern. They make and a couple of them go even further. A couple of them last as long as Greenland, and every now and then a rare storm actually makes it to Europe.
Mm.
So that's the predictable hurricane track. If you look at the at the patterns historically of hurricanes, many of them have Florida obviously is vulnerable, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and even Texas, as we know, was subject to a hurricane at the turn of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
Which it killed 6,000 to 8,000 people
in Galveston.
The city of Galveston.
Yeah.
So the whole Gulf Coast is vulnerable, and the Gulf Coast waters tend to intensify hurricanes because they're very warm, and warm water is the fuel of a tropical cyclone.
Yeah. Well, that hurricane in Galveston continued up through, it made landfall, and it continued up through, and it affected the Midwest and the tornadoes that it spun off.
Tornadoes are commonly spun off on the fringes of hurricanes.
Yeah.
Hurricane Ivan spun off more than 100 tornadoes altogether. Katrina, which did so much damage to New Orleans, actually subsided relatively quickly. It didn't make it more than 100 or so miles inland before it collapsed into no more than a tropical storm.
Yeah.
But occasionally, hurricanes do hit the Midwest. They're pretty rare. They've even made it as far as the prairies on rare occasions if the meteorological kind of preconditions are right. But those are rare. Generally, once hurricanes make landfall, they do decelerate fairly rapidly and generally transit into not much more than tropical storms.
Yeah. Well, there can be tornadoes associated with hurricanes, but then tornadoes can form without
tornadoes
a hurricane.
Tornadoes can also form from thunder cells.
Right.
And, with Tornado Alley, which goes out through the central part of the United States, those thunder cells are a product of the warm air coming in from the Gulf, meeting the drier air drifting over the Sierras from the Pacific, and drier, cooler air, and occasionally intersecting also with cooler air from Canada. But mostly it's the cool air coming in from the Pacific and the warm air coming up the Gulf, which causes those thunder cells. Fortunately, out of every 100 or so thunder cells, fewer than 2 or 3 ever devolve into tornadoes. But, of course, when they do, they're enormously destructive.
Yeah.
Tornadoes are the single most powerful wind force on the planet by quite a long way. It's very difficult to know exactly how fast the winds are traveling because they generally destroy the instrumentation sent to measure them. But there are quite credible suspicions that winds in excess of 400 or even 500 kilometers, 300 miles an hour, are not uncommon within tornadoes. Fortunately, their extent is a lot less than a hurricane, obviously.
Yeah. Now, already this spring, the spring of 2006, here in Illinois, we've seen more tornadoes and severe thunderstorms than average. So far, in 2006, 60 tornadoes in Illinois.
That's right, and they've been very destructive. One reason for that is simply the overarching pattern. The wind, the water from the Gulf has been exceptionally warm for the last 2 or 3 years, and we're currently in what they call a La Nina episode, which means the eastern Pacific is unusually cool. And that has exaggerated the characteristics which do tend to generate tornadoes. So this is not to say this will persist, but it's been an unsettling beginning to the season, yes.
Yeah, 20 tornadoes on Easter Sunday.
Yes, and quite a number of fatalities in various parts of the central states.
Yeah. The annual average number of tornadoes in Illinois, 39.
Annually.
Yeah, annually, yeah.
yeah.
So there are cycles then for thunder cells and tornadoes, as there are for
like any other natural phenomenon, they're produced by a predictable set of preconditions. It's not always easy to know when all those preconditions will coalesce and produce the result. I mean, hurricanes, one of the really interesting things about tropical storms is it's very, very difficult to see why they actually begin. If you track them back through radar records and you track them back to a tropical depression, for every one that forms into a hurricane, there must be 15 or 16 or more, probably 25, that simply dissolve. Now, it's simply unknown what trips a tropical depression into becoming a cyclone. It's still to the precipitating device must be so minute that it's still below our radar in both senses of that phrase. But it's thought to be, and hurricanes, while enormously, enormously destructive, are curiously vulnerable when they begin. And if there are slightly disruptive patterns, maybe a high altitude wind, which causes wind shear, for example, they simply won't begin. And there are some suggestions, although this is very hard to prove, that something as small as the storm passing over in its very initial stages over a large cruise ship may disrupt it fatally and may prevent it from becoming a hurricane. But there's no way of predicting that, and there's no way of sending cruise ships out into the tropical Atlantic to prevent hurricanes, because it's possible they may, quite the contrary, make things worse rather than better. Nobody knows.
Yeah, it's very interesting. You know, there are atmospheric conditions at work, but there is also geography at work, and the cruise ship would be geography.
Cruise ship, in that sense, is a piece of geography. A single resort hotel has been known to divert a hurricane from its predicted path, but you can't, all the scientific efforts to divert or destroy hurricanes have to deal with the fact that they're chaotic systems and are incredibly difficult to predict. And the danger is always that an intervention would end up causing a worse damage than simply letting it be.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Mark DeVilliers. His latest book is Windswept, The Story of Wind and Weather. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion here on the Afternoon Magazine with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-9455. WILL. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Good afternoon, Celeste.
Hi.
I'm wondering if your guest thinks that global warming is responsible in part for our sort of violent weather changes that we've noticed in the last couple of decades. I guess that's question number one.
Right. Well, the answer to that question is that it's clearly having some effect. It's the actual what the nature of this effect is not yet clear. As I said, the number of tropical cyclones globally has in fact decreased over the last couple of years, rather than increased. But their intensity has increased quite sharply, and the given reason for that, the most plausible reason for that, is increasing sea surface temperatures in tropical waters, which is a byproduct of global warming. So, yes, they're having some effect. But one of the curious and interesting things about wind and global warming is that as the atmosphere warms up, it is quite plausible that it will produce higher velocity, high altitude winds, which would in turn tend to diminish the number of tropical storms because they're vulnerable to high-altitude winds. So global warming, the fact that we're getting slightly fewer, except, of course, in the Atlantic, and last year was a terrible example of overproduction of hurricanes, but it's still plausibly a byproduct of warming that we get fewer but more intense storms. And whether they're producing more hurricane, more tornadoes, and more erratic weather is still a matter of great dispute, and it's at this stage improbable.
Okay, thank you. May I ask one more?
Sure,
of course.
Go ahead.
All right, and I don't want to sound like a grand conspiracy going on here, but I have read several things out on the net that talk about governments, whether it's Japanese, Chinese, Russian, U.S., have been involved in weather manipulation, and not so much to help areas that need rain and help it produce rain in those areas, but actually do the reverse, so
well,
to try to do a negative economic
effect.
You
mean weather manipulation as an act of aggression, do you mean?
Yes.
Well, you know, weather manipulation has a fairly long and quite honorable history. I know their cloud seeding, for example, to produce rain in rainfall areas has a history going back almost as far as high-altitude aviation. And, in fact, the South African government only 2 years ago was still experimenting with silver iodide crystals in cloud formations to try and end a local drought. The one reason for a high degree of skepticism about whether this is in fact happening as a deliberate act of policy is that in the state of human knowledge now, it's simply impossible to predict the effects of such manipulation, and you're just as likely to suffer from your own manipulations as somebody else is, because again, it's a weather and the atmospheric systems are so complex, and they tend to be what they call chaotic or non-linear systems, and they're not predictable in the way that normal linear systems are. So that if you're say a Cuban and you want to steer a hurricane under Florida instead of under you, the chances are you're going to get it wrong. I mean, there's simply no way of doing that credibly. So there may well be governments somewhere or corporations somewhere trying to manipulate the weather, but I can assure you that it's not being done with any degree of credibility or effectiveness.
And it's a question of scale and all the complexities.
Well, the scale also. I mean, there have been all kinds of wonderful, kind of strange theories about how to diminish the effects of hurricanes, or to deprive them of their fuel, which is warm tropical water. I mean, one theory was to spread a film of biodegradable oil, for example, over the earth, over the sea surface in the path of the hurricane to prevent it from sucking up the water. But the problem is you're going to need to cover several thousand square miles of ocean with a film of oil. First of all, how are you going to get it there in time? Second of all, where are you going to get all this oil? This is millions of tons of this stuff. Secondly, what is it going to do to the wildlife in the ocean?
Yeah.
So the fact that most of these so-called solutions are really not at all credible.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Sycamore on line 4. Good afternoon.
Yeah, good afternoon. I believe I heard you mention just a little while ago that there was a case where a single resort hotel was able to have an effect on at least a bit of the path of a hurricane. And that prompted me to ask what you think the effects of large wind turbine farms are. There are a lot of these going up in Illinois that are harvesting wind power, and I think highly effectively.
Right.
But if you put enough of them up, what's going to happen? Do you have
any thoughts? Well, I think the real answer to that is nothing, because the wind, curious enough, I mean, one of the interesting things about wind turbines is that the wind, of course, passes through them almost by definition. They do drive the blades, but the wind is only diverted and diminished to a very modest degree. A single high-rise building has much more effect on wind and weather than so far, anyway, than all of the wind farms so far constructed, because it's a dense slab of building of material which can in fact divert and change local climatic conditions. The other thing to be said about that is that it's much more difficult to change local climates than you might think. Hurricanes are curious in that they are self-contained moving systems, and they're vulnerable to forces that steer them. They're not necessarily vulnerable after they form to forces that try and diminish or intensify them, apart from water temperatures. So while in the very embryo stages of a storm, a small intrusion might divert the storm, or if it's very, very early days, might cause it to cease or to stop developing, organizing. That doesn't happen with major systems and major storms. And to answer your question about wind farms, most of those are in areas of prevailing, at least in the eastern North America, tend to be in the prevailing westerly winds. And these are not going to be affected because these are among the largest and broadest and most consistent forces in meteorology. I don't think they're going to be affected by human development in that stage.
Okay, very interesting. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call. We've got another listener waiting to talk with us. Before I go to this individual, though, I want to ask you what you think the promise or the drawbacks are, or both pros and cons, of wind farms.
Well, the big hit against wind farms is, first of all, that they're intermittent. That's the great drawback as far as predictable power is concerned. It's a bit of a red herring, in my opinion, because you take the country of Denmark, which has so far produces around 27% of its power from wind against a target to date of only 20. They're way ahead of their targets. And their problem, their experience is that if the wind farms are decentralized sufficiently, this intermittent problem is almost always avoidable. Their problem has, quite the contrary, been overproduction. They tend to have to ship power to Norway when the wind's blowing too steadily. That's more political than technological, because they've guaranteed their wind producers that they would buy their power, so they have to export some of it. So that's the big hit against wind power, is that it's intermittent, and I think this is it's overstated, because it is solvable by decentralizing production to a degree. Then you get into all much more subjective arguments against wind power, that they're enormous, that they're ugly. They always seem to be in places that are pristine and beautiful landscapes, because that's where it's easiest to capture the wind. And people simply think, according to your preconceptions, that they're either ugly or elegant. I happen to fall on the slightly, I think they're quite graceful, personally, and I've spent quite a lot of time around them. And the other thing is the story about their noise. Well, the new ones are simply not noisy. You can barely hear them.
Mm.
So is wind power the panacea? No, but, if we can produce 15-20% of our energy needs through renewables, of which wind is one of them, this lessens the burden on other technologies, and it by definition is a good thing. Now, do you want to put wind turbines up in the middle of national parks and places like that? No, I don't think so. The biggest controversy with an American wind farm has been off Nantucket Island, where a developer wants to put up a fairly significant wind farm within within view of the, among other things, the Kennedy compound, which is causing a good deal of ruckus. Offshore may be one of the answers. Offshore winds, developers like them because sea winds are more stable and predictable, less turbulent, shall we say, than shore winds. And so maybe that's the way to do it, offshore, out of sight of land.
Yeah. Where our caller lives in Sycamore, where he called from, there's a wind farm not far from there in a community called Pawpaw.
Uh-huh.
And if you go up Interstate 39, you come across it, and it's striking.
They are striking. Again, if your preconceptions are that they destroy the landscape, then you'll regard them as ugly. My I guess my answer to that is, ugly as compared to what? If the alternative is a coal-fired generating plant, I would say they're not ugly at all. If the argument is about putting in nothing, then yeah, I guess they're an industrial artifact in a natural landscape, and they're not they're not natural. So
maybe in this part of the country they don't bother us so much because we have a fondness, I do for grain elevators and silos.
Well, grain elevators, yeah, you could make the same argument about the intrusiveness of grain elevators in a natural landscape, but people have become used to them, just as they became used to Dutch windmills, in the old days, and now they're regarded as picturesque rather than intrusive. But when they were first built, they were very controversial.
Huh. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Charleston on line two. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Two questions. The first is, here locally, and I think near Champaign County at Douglas and around, there's this roar about a new coal-fired generating plant.
Right.
And my question is, I only know what I've read in the paper,
right,
that they are going to project the pollutants under the ground, pump them.
I think what they're doing is called sequestration of CO2, carbon dioxide. And this is a technique of basically when the coal is burned, they have scrubbers in the emissions vehicle, in the chimneys, effectively, which filter out the carbon dioxide through catalytic agents, and those are then collected on mats and essentially either buried as solids if they're crystalline, or simply pumped into shafts for essentially sequestration. Is just a fancy word for burial, really. A number of countries are doing this significantly. Britain is depositing huge tonnages of carbon dioxide into depleted oil wells under the North Sea, for example. There are a number of experiments going on throughout the Canadian prairies and the Midwest and various other places for pumping CO2 into deep mine shafts. And so this is one way of the intention is to prevent this escaping into the atmosphere and therefore becoming a greenhouse gas.
Yes, well, that is the sandstone, I think, is what they're saying here in the Midwest. You can go through that and it'd be accumulated and held there.
Well, the technology is certainly proven for short-term storage of carbon dioxide. Whether it works on the long term, of course, nobody knows because it hasn't been around. That technology hasn't been around long enough to understand whether it's an effective technology over the multiple decades or indeed multiple centuries that the holding of this stuff would be necessary.
And that's the part that worries me. If the science is not there, if they can't articulate that, then some sort of experimentation should have taken place.
Well, the problem is, I agree with you, but the problem is that you need an experiment that lasts as long as the actual event is going to do. And all they can do at the moment is build as much containment as they can and essentially hope for the best. Well, the argument is it's better than pumping it directly into the air.
Yes, well, and we don't know the out, and I understand that.
Yeah.
My second question would be the term global warming and the effects of that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I do know now, I'm just a layman, and I listen and I read.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that the discussion about it now is for the emissions that hold in the sunlight, the heat from the sun, and it can't escape again.
Correct.
Well, the cumulative effect of that, if there's effects now of global warming, the first thing that pops to my mind is Krakatoa and the winter that caused.
Right.
Whenever the sun's rays cannot get through the
snow. Well, there's an interesting irony that you've raised. It's an interesting point because volcanoes and their emissions, which are solid particulates, actually prevent the sun's warmth from reaching the Earth and therefore have a cooling effect on the planet. This is not to suggest that we should set off volcanoes to counteract global warming, because we have no way of controlling any of that. The actual global warming is produced through mostly through methane. Carbon dioxide is the great villain, and the gases that hold the sun's heat into the planet's atmosphere are largely water vapor, over which we have little control, and carbon dioxide, over which we have actually quite considerable control now that we're producing so much of it.
So
those are the two gases that are the primary greenhouse.
And that they are no solid particulates that evolve to blot out the sun then from the
right.
gases.
Well,
the gases are clear.
The solid particulates actually cool things down rather than warm things up.
Yes. Well, I see pictures of China
yes.
And how polluted, and then what California used to be in England.
Well,
the 50s.
I was in China 3 years ago doing some filming there, and we were in the northern part of China when they underwent one of their notorious dust storms. In fact, if you watch the news a couple of days ago, there's been another one. And you, for days on end, you simply can't see the sky. It's a milky white color, and it's highly polluted with all kinds of toxins, and they've tracked Chinese dust and Chinese toxins all the way to Hawaii, which that's a fair distance.
Yes, well, thank you very much, sir. That takes me up the road a bit.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments are invited. Here are the telephone numbers, 333-9455. That's the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon here in this portion of the afternoon magazine, Mark DeVilliers. His latest book is Windswept, The Story of Wind and Weather. In the book, you tell a wonderful story early in the book, of a day at the beach and a question posed by one of your cousins. And this was how it was that you began to think about air and wind. Tell us that story, please.
Well, my cousin, who always had a slightly odd take on things, we were catching rock lobsters as kids in the Indian Ocean, which is nice and warm. You didn't have to go down very far to do that. And, he was just wondering whether if the lobster couldn't see the water, if you look up and there are fish going overhead, are they flying? Or how do they stay up there?
Yeah.
And in a sense, lobsters being bottom feeders, they're living at the bottom of this kind of tower of substance, which is very likely to them completely invisible. It's simply, it's like air was to the ancients. They didn't think much about air because they didn't know there was anything there to think about. It was simply a nothingness. So, and it got me thinking about, well, in a sense, we too are living, we're also bottom feeders. We're living at the bottom of this towering atmospheric pile of what exactly? So I became curious about how the air, what the air was, what it consisted of, and in fact, how people began to think of it early on. The history of trying to think about air is quite interesting because how do you think, when if you don't know it exists, how do you think about it? That's the curious thing about it, because there's nothing to grasp, in a sense, there. And it's only when you know that air has substance that you begin to understand what wind is. To the ancients, wind was a complete mystery. It just came out of nowhere, and it batted you and then disappeared. And it was self-evidently to them the work of malicious gods, because what else could it be?
Mm.
So those are the questions always set off these trains of thought. And it's only very recently that we understood what wind or what air really is, right? Very recently in human history.
Yeah, it was very interesting and very curious that in centuries past, people didn't realize weather traveled.
No, they didn't seem to have a clue because, again, it just appeared, if you read the Shakespearean Tempest or Defoe's Storm or any of the writings about wind in the old days, It was. They knew what it was, but they had no idea why it was, or that it came from somewhere. And it really wasn't until the early days of the new United States, and you know, people like Franklin, who began to track storms and realized that the same storm that hit Philadelphia actually hit Boston shortly afterwards. And then it was only then that they understood that whole systems travel. And it puzzled me when I was first thinking about this, because to us it seems so obvious. Mm-hmm. Because you can be at sea and you can watch a storm coming and you can watch it pass overhead and then you can watch it disappearing in the other direction. So why didn't they get it? Well, they didn't get it because they didn't know what they were. They had no idea what produced these things or what they were or how they worked or anything about them. And so they seemed arbitrary in the most, you know, in the most discouraging way. They just seemed so. There had to be some malicious force involved.
Yeah.
That's a normal human reaction to something you don't understand.
Well, sure. Imagine being a sailor hundreds of years ago.
Well, Christopher Columbus was the first one that we know of. Obviously, many other mariners survived hurricanes, but he was the first one who actually survived one and talk about it. But he had no idea either that it was. A cyclone in a sense. He had no idea. He just knew the signs of a hurricane coming. There was a kind of eerie calm beforehand, and then the sea would kind of start swelling into these oily swells, and he knew that something bad was going to happen, but he didn't know it was coming from somewhere. He just thought it was slowly boiling up where he was. And that was fairly typical. Even mariners who were sophisticated in the ways of the trade winds and could find their way easily back from Europe to America and then take the westerlies back to America on the northerly route, they understood winds, but they didn't understand that weather was often a self-contained and a movable system. And that's because they had no idea of fronts or troughs or ridges or any of the things that we've become familiar with from our weather forecasts.
Yeah. Well, if you've ever been on the water and it's a little rough or it's terribly foggy, you can put yourself back into someone's shoes.
Well, there's nothing more intimidating than being on the ocean in a gale in a small boat, because it's you can see very quickly how fast the water is heaped up into massive swells by something considerably less than a gale even. Oh. And if you're in a hurry, I've never, thank God, been on the sea in a hurricane, but people who have and have described it, the sea is chaotic and turbulent because by definition the winds are coming from all directions and the water is being pushed in all directions. And that is one of the things that destroys more ships in high winds than the wind itself does.
Yeah. You know, when we think today about measuring conditions, we think of thermometers and barometers, we think of Doppler radar, we think of the imagery that satellites can provide us.
Exactly.
When were the first measurements made, and how were they made? What were they measuring?
Well, the very first barometer was made by a protege of Galileo's, Torricelli, and it was simply a device that swelled when the pressure, air pressure, went down, and that was the very first time that anybody was actually able to measure a meteorological phenomenon apart from temperature. It was only 30 to 40 years after that that ships were routinely carrying what they called the glass. You can read in literature of the glass is falling. Well, this was a glass tube with a bulb at the bottom, with a column of water which would go up and down as the pressure of the atmospheric pressure changed. Now, even then, they had no real idea. No real understanding of the mechanisms involved or of the low pressures in storms. All they knew is when the glass is falling, bad things are coming. So that was the first time they actually measured anything, any natural phenomena to do with weather.
Yeah, and it was much later before the sort of people figured out what was going on with jet streams and layers of atmosphere.
The jet streams, of course, had to wait for high-level aviation. They our knowledge of high-altitude weather was really driven from the First World War onwards, when we first had air forces, and those lethal but terribly fragile little airplanes their pilots had a desperate need to understand what was going on in the high atmosphere. But it really wasn't until jet travel that we understood the jet streams themselves, the high-altitude bands of winds that travel at very substantial velocities around the Earth. Now they're kind of routine. You know, anybody who travels across the Atlantic knows that you get there faster if you're traveling east than if you're traveling west, because you're riding the jet stream to get there. Planes routinely fly into the jet stream, although they're traveling at 300 miles an hour, but they're traveling horizontally, and so they're not deadly to airplanes.
Mm. So much here to wonder at.
There's lots to wonder at.
Yes. Well, we have to wrap up here. We're out of time, unfortunately. Mark DeVilliers, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
You're very welcome.
His latest book, our guest's latest book, is Windswept, The Story of Wind and Weather. The publisher is Walker. And that interview was conducted on April 25th of this year. You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. It is 8 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Jim Meadows.
Thank you, Celeste. And first, let's take a look at wheat out of Kansas City, where the high price was $4.88 for September wheat, the low $4.83, settling at $4.84, down 1.5. December wheat, the high price $5.01.5, the low price $4.97. It settled at $500, down 1/4. March wheat, the high price $5.06, the low price $5.02.5, settling at $5.03.75, down 3/4. Now to the Chicago Board of Trade and September wheat, the high $3.91, the low $3.85.5, settling at $3.88.5, up 3/4. December wheat, the high price $4.10, the low price $4.05.5, settling at $4.08, up 3/4. March wheat, the high price $4.26.5, the low price $4.22, settling at $4.24.5, that was unchanged. For May wheat, the high price $4.34.5, the low price $4.31.5, settling at $4.32.5, down 1. July wheat at $4.41 for the high, $4.37 for the low, settling at $4.38.75, down 1.25. Looking at corn, September corn $2.39.25 for the high, the low $2.36.5, settling at $2.37.25, down 1/2. December corn $2.56 for the high, the low $2.53, settling at $2.53.5, down 3/4. March corn at $2.69.75 for the high, the low $2.67, settlement $2.67.25, down 1. May corn, the high $2.79, the low $2.76.75, settling at $2.76.